talking hellos consist of Myla Goldberg, Val, Opielski. Thank you. Opielski, Rose Thompson, and Heather Wagner. We make music in a bedside basement with the help of a banjo, a mutant guitar, sound loops, accordion, bass, and drums. Their debut LP, Because I Wanted to Know, was released this spring. It's my great pleasure to give you The Walking Hellos.
Thank you. why you didn't hear my accordion for that entire thing, because I think the amp wasn't on yet. But for the next one, it will be, and you'll be able to hear everything. That song was called The Endurance because it's about Ernest Shackleton. Any of your Shackleton fans out there? Woohoo! We got one! South Pole Explorer, I figured on a record hot day, nothing better than a song about the South Pole.
Thank you, Walking Hellos. The first author of the night is Amelia Gray, who came in from somewhere that is not New York, so I don't know what it is. Amelia Gray's writing has appeared in American Short Fiction, McSweeney's Internet Tendency, Diagram, and Cake Train, among others. She's the author of AMPM, published by Featherproof Books, and Museum of the Weird, which is due in September through Fiction Collective 2. Visit her online at ameliagray.com, but not right now, because you'll be listening to her on stage. It is my great pleasure to give you the woman who flew in, Amelia Gray.
Tell you I don't have a steady hand. I could paint individual whorls on your fingertip with your own eyelash. I can judge the delicate motion of a cube in a bowl, and I could shave it with a straight razor if I wanted to. I could quite literally devour you. You think I'm scared of you? I'm not sure if you caught this, but in that half second when you reached for the door, I came up next to you, drilled a hole in your heel, and attached a tube through which I am currently collecting your bone marrow. It is going into this bag. I am going to sell it. I will gather your oldest friends at my home, and we will have a conversation. You will hear us talking, but when you come into the room, we will stop talking. I will lock you in a room that looks much like your own until it begins to fill with water. You think you've got it figured out, don't you? Figure this. You are the acid in my guts. You are the pile of sand behind the curtain of my memory. You are the fish on the hook of my ugly heart. You are the tie around your own neck. I will hold my finger half an inch away from your left eye until the end of days. You are going to ask me why I'm doing all this, and I'm going to laugh, and you are going to wish you kept a picture of my laughing face in your wallet. Think you can escape? I will find you. I will compensate your friends for the information they offer me regarding your whereabouts. They will stand in their door frames and hold the money. They will watch me drive away. Left to my own devices, I will go insane on your ass. I will cross-stitch an image of our future home burning, a smaller image of you straight up rending your garments, gnashing. I will hang these images over your bed while you sleep. The Shastras say that the truth should harm no one. My truth is such that it will cause black rain upon the heads of your children. Nobody asked for your opinion, but I am kind enough to offer a response. I will strip the bark from a tree and make you new clothes. You will wear these clothes as you wander the forest for 14 years. Your mother will die watching the sky, and your father will forget your name. I'm reading a book called Threats. You are another disappointing rerun on a long list of promising programming. I'm going to film you running and then broadcast that film on local television. We interrupt this program to bring you a coward. I will create a set of work responsibilities that are inconvenient and demeaning to you, and I will convince your boss to run with it. We'll call it the Bathroom Scrub Challenge, but the secret is there's no real challenge to it. This was scrubbing. Curl up on my lap, Let me brush your hair with my fingers. I am singing you a lullaby. I am testing for structural weakness in your skull. Try to kiss me. See what happens to your lips. My truth is a sucking chest wound. The field doctor will apply a makeshift occlusive patch crafted from cellophane, aluminum foil, and duct tape. You are far from home. I will cover my tracks in pursuit of you. I will step into the same river twice. I will never lose your scent. I will wear special clothing that makes me look like you. I will stand very close and you will not see. I will breathe like you. I will staple my address to your winter coat, little one. When you are lost after school and scrubbing tears off your face with your mitten, they will send you to me, no matter what you claim.
Thanks, Amelia. I'm going to take all of these threats and bring them with me to therapy. The next reader of the night is Shane Jones, who is good, excellent. He's at his mark. Give everyone their marks. He's at his. Shane Jones is the author of the novel Lightboxes, first published by Publishing Genius Press, and recently re-released by Penguin Books. Shane lives in upstate New York. It's my great pleasure to give you Shane Jones.
I'm going to read a love story now. It's called I Will Unfold You With My Hairy Hands. The hair monster checked out the ass of the handicapped woman. She was standing with her back turned when the hair monster noticed her panty line against her white tights and thought, hey, hey, hey. He was a typically lonely hair monster and often looked at women trying to imagine what it would feel like to caress their human skin. He kept watching her as she walked away, and that's when he noticed her hands balled up against her chest, her chin tucked down and rubbing against her knuckles as she shuffled her feet. The hair monster looked away, feeling ashamed, questioning just what kind of hair monster he really was. His mother had raised him better. The handicapped woman's name was Stacy, and although she saw the hair monster check her out and kind of liked the attention, she told the rest of her handicapped friends, who happened to all be guys who were secretly in love with her. They now hated the hair monster. They loved Stacy even more. The hair monster couldn't stop thinking about Stacy. His mother hadn't raised him better. He went back to the music store every day hoping to see her again. He spent his afternoons waiting at the listening station where he had first checked her out. He listened to Neil Young a lot, his short little hairy body bouncing up and down during the fast songs. His hairy head hung low during the slow ones. The song, A Man Needs a Maid, always made the hair monster cry. The wiry hair under his eyes became wet and matted like strips of hay left out in the rain. A week later, Stacy went to the music store with her four guy friends, who decided to sit in the cafe and drink cappuccinos. The hair monster saw Stacy at a listening station, and he patted the hair on his head and pressed the hair on his neck down. Hello, he said, approaching her at the listening station. It's nice to meet you. Stacy was listening to Al Green. She saw the hair monster standing next to her and saw his mouth moving and wanted him to be saying something sweet and romantic like Al Green would say. When she took the headphones off, she heard the hair monster speaking loud and slow. I said hello and it's nice to meet you, he pointed at her. I would, he pointed at himself, like to talk to you, he pointed at her. The four guys in the cafe saw this interaction take place and, loaded with multiple cappuccinos, walked over to confront the hair monster. You stay away from Stacy, one of them wearing a New York Yankee sweatshirt and matching sweatpants said. We hate you, hair monster, another sighed. The hair monster told them that he meant no harm, that all he wanted was to talk to Stacy. No, one shouted. You're nothing but a hair monster. Go away, the one wearing the Yankee sweatshirt and sweatpants said. Now. So the hair monster did. He left the music store humming A Man Needs a Maid, imagining running his fingers through Stacy's long, silky blonde hair. Stacy watched the hair monster, all hairy and hunched over, trying to remember what Al Green sang, feeling a warmth splinter her body with each word she could remember to hum.
Thank you, Shane. So the final offer of the night is a return customer. Actually, you know, the whole night has had a very nice progression. Amelia Gray, this is not the funny part. This is where I'm being real, sharing a part of myself that's genuine. That's more like it. So the night has had a cool progression because Amelia just emailed me out of the blue, and I invited her to read. Shane, I had been trying to book him for a long time, like 8-9 months or something. He's one of those, he's now a person, but for 8 months he was just a book, and in my apartment, and Lightboxes was in my apartment on a small pile that said, yes, yes, but when? And I finally got him in after 8 months. And Audrey Niffenegger is a return customer, so isn't that a nice progression? And Mila has read here before. Come on. That's lovely. All right, here we go. You know, I try and be real with you guys, and nothing. Audrey Niffenegger lives in Chicago, where she's a visual artist and writer. She's a founding member of Text 3, an artist and writers group that also performs and exhibits in Chicago. Her work is in the collections of the Library of Congress, the Art Institute of Chicago, the National Museum of Women in the Arts, and the Newbery Library. She's the author of 2 visual novels, The Three Incestuous Sisters and The Adventuress. Her short story, The Night Bookmobile, was serialized as a graphic novel in the London Guardian last year. Her first novel, The Time Traveler's Wife, was published in 2003 and was a national bestseller. Her new book, the critically acclaimed national bestseller, Fearful Symmetry, which is hard to say out loud if you have my math, was published by Scribner in 2009. The novel is set in and around London's historic Highgate Cemetery, where Niffenegger, a self-proclaimed cemetery tourist, is an occasional guide. It is my great pleasure to give you Audrey Niffenegger.
The bit that I'm going to read is a chapter called She's Leaving Home. And the characters in this particular chapter are Martin Wells, who is a crossword setter and a linguist, translator, and his wife Marika Wells de Graaf, who has been very, very patient with her husband for a very long time, but finally can't take it anymore. Martin is exceedingly charming and wonderful, and he just has this one problem, which is that he has obsessive compulsive disorder. And to visualize the flat, it's completely full of boxes. And inside the boxes are most of their possessions, which he has covered in cling wrap and taped up and put in the boxes. He's got a lot of other habits as well. He counts and he washes and does a lot of things which he's doing to manage anxiety. But Marika, who loves him very, very much, just finally be there anymore, so the chapter's called She's Leaving Home. Marika Wells de Graaf stood in the doorway of the bedroom she had shared with Martin for the last 23 years. She had 3 letters in her hand, and she was debating with herself about where to leave one of them. Her suitcases stood on a landing by the front stairs with her yellow trench coat neatly folded over them. She had only to leave the letter, and she could go. Martin was in the shower. He had been in there for about 20 minutes. He would stay in the shower for another hour or so, even after the hot water ran out. Marika made a point of not knowing what he was up to in there. She could hear him talking to himself, a low, amiable mumble. It could almost have been the radio. This is radio insanity, she thought, coming at you with all the latest and greatest OCD hits. She wanted to leave the letter in a place where he would find it soon, but not too soon. And she wanted to leave it in a spot that wasn't already problematic for Martin, so that he'd be able to pick the letter up and open it. But she didn't want to put it in a place which would be contaminated by the presence of the letter, which would then be forever associated with the letter and therefore unbound to Martin in the future. She'd been pondering this dilemma for weeks without settling on a spot. She'd almost given up and resolved to post the letter, but she didn't want Martin to worry when she didn't come home from work. I wish I could leave it hovering in midair, she thought. And then she smiled and went to get her sewing kit. Marika stood in Martin's office next to his computer, trying to steady her hands enough to thread the needle in the pool of yellow light from his desk lamp. Their flat was very dark. Martin had papered over the windows, and she could only tell that it was morning by the white light that showed through the sellotape at the edges of the newspaper. Needle threaded, she whipped a few stitches around the edge of the envelope, and then stood on Martin's chair to tape the end of the thread to the ceiling. Marika was tall, but she had to stretch, and for a moment she had a sensation of vertigo, wobbling on the chair in the dark room. It would be a bad joke if I fell and broke myself now. She imagined herself on the floor with her head cracked open, the letter dangling above her. But a second later, she recovered her balance and stepped off the chair. The letter seemed to levitate above the desk. Perfect. She gathered her sewing things and pushed in the chair. Martin called her name. Marika stood frozen. What? She finally called out. She set the sewing supplies on Martin's desk. Then she walked into the bedroom and stood at the closed bathroom door. What? She held her breath. She hid the remaining two letters behind her back. There's a letter for Teo on my desk. Could you post it on your way out? Okay. Thanks. Marika opened the door a crack. Steam filled the bathroom and moistened her face. She hesitated. Martin? Her mind went blank. Tot ziens, Martin, she finally said. Tot ziens, my love. Martin's voice was cheerful. See you tonight. Tears welled in her eyes. She walked slowly out of the bedroom, edged her way between the piles of plastic-wrapped boxes in the hall, ducked into the office, picked up Martin's letter to Teo, and continued through the front hall and out the door of their flat. Marika stood with her hand on the doorknob. A random memory came to her. We stood here together, my hand on the doorknob, just like this. A younger hand. We were young. It was raining. We'd been grocery shopping. Marika closed her eyes and stood listening. The flat was large, and she couldn't hear Martin from here. She left the door ajar, it was never locked, and put on her coat, checked her watch. She hefted her suitcases and carried them awkwardly down the stairs, glancing briefly at Elspeth's door as she went by. When she came to the ground floor, she left one of her envelopes in Robert's mail basket. Marika did not turn to look at Boutravers as she let herself out of the gate. She walked up the path to the street, rolling her suitcases behind her. It was a cold, damp January morning. It had rained in the night. Highgate Village had a feeling of changelessness about it this morning, as though no time at all had passed since she arrived there, a young married woman, in 1981. The red phone box still stood in Pond Square, though there was no pond in Pond Square now, nor had been for as long as Marika could remember, just gravel and benches with pensioners napping on them. The old man who owned the bookstore still scrutinized the tourists as they perused his obscure maps and brittle books. A young Labrador ran across the square, easily eluding a shrieking toddler. The little restaurants, the dry cleaners, the estate agents, the chemist, all waited, as though a bomb had gone off somewhere, leaving only young mums pushing prams. As she posted Martin's letter to him along with her own, Marika thought of the hours she'd spent here with Teo. Perhaps the letters will arrive together. The driver was waiting for her at the minicab office. He slung her suitcases into the boot and they got into the car. Heathrow, he asked. Yes, Terminal 4, said Marika. They headed down the North Hill toward the Great North Road.